Paula Kaplan is the author of several books, including The Myth of Women's Masochism, Don't Blame Mother, and They Say You're Crazy, How the World's Most Powerful Psychiatrists Decide Who's Normal. An activist against the harm caused by psychiatric labels, Dr. Kaplan has been a full professor of psychology, assistant professor of psychiatry, and a lecturer in women's studies at the University of Toronto. A clinical and research psychologist, she was chosen by the American Psychological Association as, quote, an eminent woman psychologist. And she was also formerly a consultant to those who construct the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Her latest book is Bias in Psychiatric Diagnosis. Paula, I'd like to welcome you to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
For starters, you're the editor of a new book that examines bias in psychiatric diagnosis. Now, before starting on this topic, let's be frank about what some might consider to be your bias. You're a woman, a feminist, and a psychologist. Mm-hmm. How has this informed your bias on the topic of psychiatric diagnosis?
What a great question. Well, all of those lead me to want to think critically about everything, not just about this topic. And all of those lead me to be concerned about unhappiness and injustice. And when I see that happening, I want to know why is it happening and what can we do to change it. And so, yes, I'm very much biased in the direction of being opposed to injustice and suffering.
I think it's important to be honest about one's perspective.
Yes, I do too.
Frequently, those who claim to not be biased, that is, not affected by the world that we live in, they frequently mask ideology as, mm-hmm. as objective truth.
I should say, whenever I teach or whenever I give a talk, I always say that if there's a time for discussion, I want to say, feel free to disagree with me. If you know something and that shows that I'm wrong, that I reported something that seemed to be factual but that's not so, please let me know. And feel free to object to what I'm saying, because yes, of course I'm biased.
Now let's get into your latest book. It's entitled Bias in Psychiatric Diagnosis. Can you give us an overview of some of the chapters and contributors of the book?
This book was really a dream of mine because it started out very small. It wasn't even going to be a book. About 10 or 15 years ago, after They Say You're Crazy had come out, I was thinking back to the way I had been trained as a psychologist. I got my PhD, and I thought, I bet I could tell you in about 10 minutes everything I learned in 4 years of training that's ever really been of use to anybody else that I've been trying to help. And I thought, there are no materials for training programs for therapists that tell them the kind of thing that I had learned by being on two committees of the Diagnostic Psychiatric Manual. And so the idea initially was, let me just get together a couple of just two or three page papers about topics here and there having to do with diagnosis. And I was working with other feminists, and so one was going to be about women in depression, and one was going to be about women in agoraphobia, and so on. And we were just going to duplicate them and then ask training programs, do you want to use these? That was all. And it was a long, sad story why we couldn't get any institutional or organizational support for doing that. And then one day, Dr. Joan Chrysler, who's at Connecticut College, said, why don't I talk to the head of the Association for Women in Psychology, which is a wonderful activist group with a strong clinical orientation, and see if they would be interested in making it a project of AWP. And in short, that's what they did. Well, when it became a project, we were thinking, with an AWP endorsement, maybe it could be a book, maybe publishers would be interested. So we ended up having a very short time to deadline once we got the contract. And what I did was I just sat there and I thought, let's see, we need something about rural women. Who knows? Oh, Nikki Girard, she's in Saskatchewan. She's in Saskatoon Mental Health Clinic. Brilliant. Done the most important work about rural women. So I called Nikki and I said, I'd love you to do a chapter. I need it in 3 weeks. And she said, I'd love to do that more than anything else, but I just don't have the time. And the same thing happened. I called Bob Metcalf in Toronto, asked him to do a chapter about his brilliant work about sexuality and diagnosis. And he said, I'd love to do it. I don't have the time. That happened with several people that I thought were the best in the field. And I said, I'll make you a deal. You choose 1 hour. I'll phone you. I'll be sitting at my computer. I will ask you questions. Then I'll type up the answers, edit them, and send them to you and see how they look to you. And you can make any changes. Well, it worked beautifully because since I'm a very controlling editor, I had this vision for the book and I knew what I wanted to have in there. I knew what these people knew. And so I was able to sort of shape the way the chapter was going to look by the questions that I asked them. And their ideas were already so well formed and they were so articulate that it was so fast and so easy. And we got these beautiful chapters that way. So what's in the book? Well, there are several sections of the book. There's a general introduction where we talk about some of the history, who were the pioneers in questioning psychiatric diagnosis and discovering bias, like Dr. George Albee, who's sort of the grandfather of this. He was in Vermont, now he's in Florida. Then there's a section on bias in psychiatric diagnosis as it relates to the legal system. And there are a number of chapters in there. Emily Kaplan Stevenson, who is an attorney, wrote a chapter about how psychiatric diagnosis can be helpful or can be harmful to you. She did a case history, a composite of one woman's life from birth to death, and how at many points along the way, psychiatric diagnosis somehow played a role. And at some times it was helpful to her, and at other times it was harmful. Mm-hmm. And then she went back and showed how at each of those points it could have gone the other way, and how. I wrote a chapter in that section about parental alienation syndrome. And this was a category.
Now, what's parental alienation syndrome?
This was a category that, like many allegedly psychiatric diagnostic categories, was made up by a guy, Richard Gardner. And if you read the criteria, it's really just a fancy way of saying this person's trying to turn their children against the other parent. Because of the way he constructed it and the way he wrote about it and the way he publicized and the way he testified about it in courts in many countries, it was almost always used to apply to women who, in the process of a divorce or after a divorce, had said, oh God, I have reason to suspect that maybe my ex-husband is abusing the children. So it became a knee-jerk response. The lawyer for the other parent would say, oh, by virtue of saying, I think my children are being abused, this person proves that they have parental alienation syndrome. Because, you know, if you're the lawyer for the other parent, for the abusive parent, if you want to put somebody on the stand and say, what is happening? Why is this other parent saying this? Well, if they just say, well, because they're just nasty and trying to get this nice parent in trouble, that doesn't sound as impressive as if you put a psychiatrist or a psychologist on the witness stand and they say, this other parent is suffering from parental alienation syndrome. So it's very, very dangerous category. And it's not even in the DSM. It's not in the regular psychiatric manual. But it does a lot of damage.
It's being asserted as a diagnosis, like to be in maybe the next DSM?
Richard Gardner, the inventor of it, died recently, and he tried and tried to get it in the DSM. Why they didn't put it in, I have no idea, because they put just about everything in there. But they didn't put that one in, so I suspect that now that he has died, there's not going to be the force behind it. Then there's another chapter in there about mental retardation and the death penalty, something that thankfully is not relevant to Canada, but unfortunately is very relevant still in the States. And it's that chapter is about how there was a U.S. Supreme Court decision a couple of years ago that was a declaration that you can no longer execute people who have mental retardation. And I wrote the chapter because people thought, okay, well, that's taken care of now. But as a psychologist, I taught at OISE, I taught graduate students how to do intelligence testing. And one of the things I taught them was how it's partly science, but there's a lot of art. And, you know, I can, by being supportive and smiling and nodding at you, I can help increase your scores. And if I'm a psychologist who believes in the death penalty, or I believe you should be put to death, and I'm asked to give you an IQ test, you may go over the cutoff point. Whereas if somebody else had given you the test, you wouldn't have. There are a whole lot of things that are problems with it. Then there's a whole section of the book that is about every kind of bias we could think of. So there are a couple of chapters about racism. There's one about classism. There's one about ageism. Actually, there are two about ageism, one about children and one about old people. And then there's one about homophobia and all kinds of bias about sexuality. And then the whole book has to do with disability once you're diagnosed with a psychiatric label. And then the rest of the book is about specific diagnostic labels. So there's one on depression, there's one on agoraphobia, there's one on schizophrenia, there's one on borderline personality disorder. So it's really a very rich collection. I'm just so happy with it. We have all these wonderful authors. There's one chapter in the book that I want to tell you about in particular. There's a man named Dr. Wesley Proffitt. He's a clinical psychologist. He graduated from Harvard, and he worked in a prison hospital in Massachusetts. He was head psychologist there for many years. He is black, and he's brilliant, and he just went to law school. So I said to him, he's a friend of mine, I said, Wes, we're doing this book. Is there anything you'd like to write about? And he said, well, were you aware that in preparing for the next edition of the diagnostic manual, because they have a new one every few years, you know, it's a big money maker. Mm-hmm. So they have to make sure that these become dated and everybody has to buy the new one, and they do. So Dr. Proffitt said, in preparation for the next edition, the people who are going to be putting the next edition together have appointed a committee. And they've asked that committee to address the question, should racism go in the next edition as a mental disorder? So he has written an eloquent chapter about that. As having worked in the prison system and the court system, he is in a particularly knowledgeable position to say, look at what the consequences of that would be in the court system. Somebody commits a hate crime, and all they have to say is, well, by definition of having committed a hate crime, I have a mental disorder called racism. It would, as happens with every single mental illness label, it suggests that the problem comes from within the individual. Racism, of course, is a massive social evil. And if we start saying that racism is a mental disorder, then we abdicate our responsibility as a society to mm-hmm. deal with it on a societal level. Mm-hmm. So that's a really important chapter. Oh, shall I tell you about the last chapter?
Please.
Let me tell you about the last chapter. Because it was really fun to write. I mean, we were laughing and crying at the same time. I wrote this one with Dr. Proffitt. And this one is called Some Future Contenders. And let me tell you where that title came from. I was interviewed some years ago for W5. They did a whole story about diagnosis when They Say You're Crazy came out. And one of the things they discovered, which I hadn't known about, they did this great close-up, you know, with the camera, zoomed in on this book. It wasn't the diagnostic manual itself, but it was one of the many associated products that the American Psychiatric Association publishes when they publish the manual. So they have books about how to use the manual, they have books of case studies, they have audio tapes and videotapes and CD-ROMs and DVDs and all kinds of things, big money makers. So one of these books had a chapter called Some Future Contenders, and the message was very clearly, all right, we've just gotten the latest edition of this diagnostic manual published. Now, looking toward the future, here are the ones that we're considering adding for the next edition. Because every time they have a new edition, the size, the number of alleged mental illnesses balloons. In 1987, what they called the DSM-3R, the third revised edition of the manual, came out. It had 297 categories of alleged mental illness. I know, because I counted. Then, 7 years later, the next edition came out, the DSM-4. 374 categories. So in 7 years, they got 77 more new categories. And what happened? Did 77 new kinds of mental illness get discovered? Did they develop? What's happening here? So our final chapter is called Some Future Contenders. And what we write about in that brief chapter are these two new categories that we heard about just as the book was going to press. One of them was invented by the editor of the DSM, whose name is Michael First, and another psychiatrist, I believe, at Columbia University. And here's what they say about relational disorder. They say, if there's a couple, and they're defining this as intimate partners or parents and children at this point, they say. Mm-hmm. But in the future, they can expand it. And it's possible that neither one of the people in this relationship has a mental illness. Neither one is mentally ill, but the relationship is, they say. And they go on to say, they were quoted in the Washington Post as saying this, why should I be surprised? They go on to say that to have this diagnosis in the DSM will be a very important move because it will enable people to do drug trials. Now, I ask you, picture this. A couple goes to see a psychiatrist. Sounds like it's going to be a joke, doesn't it? A couple goes to see a psychiatrist. They walk in. Neither one of them is mentally ill, but the relationship is. The psychiatrist picks up a pill. Where does the psychiatrist put the pill? It's ridiculous. Absolutely.
The relationship takes it.
The relationship takes it. There you go. There you go. You should write ads for the drug companies. So that one is just very creepy because, first of all, because they're saying they're just starting with two kinds of relationships. But then, of course, you can get to brother and sister, grandparent and grandchild, teacher and student, neighbors over the backyard fence, ex-boyfriends and girlfriends. I mean, where do you stop? And what that means, of course, is an expanding population of potential patients for the mental health system. So we're talking about big bucks. And if we're talking about drugs to treat it, then we're also talking about lots of money for the pharmaceutical companies. Now, I was once interviewed on CBC with Dr. Michael First. Michael First was the editor of the DSM, and he's one of the inventors of relational disorder. So they said, well, now Dr. First pointed out that he saw a couple, and the man was abusing the woman, and he had heart problems, and it was important to treat this relational disorder. Well, the problem with that was that it's been happening for far too many years that a couple will come in to see a therapist and the husband, usually the husband, not always, but more often, the husband is being abusive. And too many therapists treat this as it's the couple's problem. And they will say things like, they'll say to her, you know, you need to let him wear the pants in the family more often. He's beating you because you don't defer to him enough. Now, if somebody's abusive, it's their problem. It's not the couple's problem. And responsible therapists have been saying for many years now, you don't ever have a session in which the abuser and the abused are there in the same room because the abuse will happen again. You'll just be perpetuating it. So you see them separately, or you see the abuser separately and don't see the other person. But this would throw all of that stuff out the window. Now the other new category, just as the book was going to press, was, are you ready for this one?
bracing myself.
Okay. And we know it's really proposed because it was in none other than the Wall Street Journal. And it's called compulsive shopping disorder. This is what often happens. When a drug is approved by the government agency, it doesn't get approved across the board. The government doesn't say, now you can go and prescribe this drug for anything you want. They say, well, we approve this drug for the treatment of this particular condition. Now, it seems that Forest Labs, which makes a drug that in the States is called Celexa, had been approved for treatment of depression. And this went on in the States. Now, its patent on Celexa was going to expire pretty soon. And of course, when the patent on a drug expires, the other drug companies can make the same thing, and then that cuts into your profits in a serious way. But if you can find another condition and prove that, or claim is what it really amounts to, if you can claim that that same drug is useful for treating this second condition, then you can get an extension on the patent. Well, so Celexa had been approved to treat depression. Forest Labs gave a lot of money to a researcher. Now, they never give it to researchers at some crummy little unheard of university or college. It's always one with a big name if they can manage it. So somebody at Stanford University in California did two studies, according to Forest Labs, and found out that Celexa helps people who have compulsive shopping disorder. Now, that's the wording they use. And listen to the implications. Celexa helps people who have compulsive shopping disorder. Implicit in that is there is such a thing as compulsive shopping disorder. So see, right away,
they're not even questioning the basis of it.
That's right. That's right. So the thing now exists already. This entity is a real entity, a real psychiatric disorder in people's minds. And, oh, aren't we lucky? Celexa helps it. Now, there are serious problems. I mean, compulsive shopping disorder, it sounds so ridiculous. However, when I've told people about this, you would be amazed at how many people say, oh my God, I have that, or I know somebody who has that. Well, what you know is people who shop a lot. Now, there are two ways that this category is likely to be used. One is absurdly, and the other is dangerously. The absurd use will be, oh God, my wife loves to go shopping and spend my money. She's got compulsive shopping disorder. Mm-hmm. Or people being made fun of who enjoy shopping, don't overspend, use the things they buy. That's really harmless, but now they will be pathologized by anybody who wants to pathologize them. And then the dangerous use is this. There are some people, of course, who max out their credit cards, who shop in this kind of driven way, who get no pleasure from it, who don't use the things they buy and don't give them away, or they give things to people who, you know, don't really need them or appreciate them. Now, that is a problem. But consider this. If it's true that Celexa helps with that problem, given that Celexa makes people feel less depressed, what does that suggest? It suggests that people are doing this compulsive shopping because they're depressed, and it's a way, instead of drinking or smoking or gambling or whatever, they're shopping compulsively as a way to try to forget their depression. Now, if someone is depressed and what you say to them is you have compulsive shopping disorder, then you are either knowingly or unknowingly misleading them about what's wrong with them. Mm-hmm. And depression is probably in many ways the most serious kind of emotional anguish or difficulty that you can have, because it can lead to suicide. Mm-hmm. And so if I come to see you and I say I'm shopping compulsively and you say, well, here, take Celexa, and you don't say to me, you're depressed. If you say you have compulsive shopping disorder and you don't say you are depressed, and that can be dangerous. And so here's what to be on guard for. And if you have any of these feelings, you call me immediately. If you don't do that, if you say you have compulsive shopping disorder, take Celexa, Well, that's really, that should be considered malpractice. It should be something that never enters the mind of a therapist to do. The problem is that these days, so many therapists who have good intentions learn, and I put that word in quotes, learn what are the real psychiatric disorders by looking at this diagnostic manual and or by looking at the drug advertisements. So here with compulsive shopping disorder, you see an example of a change that's taken place historically, because it used to be that the drug companies would watch, and when the new DSM came out, they'd say, oh, look at this, we've got just the drug for these new things. Now they're not even waiting for the DSM, they're making these categories up themselves.